Okay, I think we're all ready to go. I want to welcome you to the Tribe Trackers Guide to History and the Future seminar, Bible seminar here at the Feast of Tabernacles. If everybody will please rise, I'll go ahead and ask a blessing on the study. Heavenly Father, we come before you this morning. We thank you for a beautiful day during the feast. We thank you for your feast and all that it means and all that we anticipate from it, and understanding that we have not only of the future but also of our past. And we just ask your blessing now on this Tribe Trackers Guide to History and the Future Bible study, and just pray that you'll give us insight and wisdom that helps us appreciate the greatness of all the work that you've been doing and all that you will do in our lives and the lives of others. So we just now place it in your hands for your inspiration and direction, and do that in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Now, hopefully you picked up a handout, and I hope we had enough to go around. I've made quite a few at the home office before coming down. Basically got enough, I think, for one for each family, and if we have more after I'm done tomorrow, and if you need more than one per family, whatever extras will be available someplace. The Tribe Trackers Guide to History and the Future. We understand the identity of America and Britain in history and in prophecy. You have more? Oh, you can just keep them back there in case somebody comes in late. Well, that'd be great. Thanks. I've got one. I've got my own copy up here, marked up with a couple of key points. But the fact is, we do understand who America is in history, and because we understand who it is in prophecy. Likewise, Great Britain and certain other Northern European nations. And we do that basically by a series of prophecies. We'll touch on those in a few minutes. But the key thing is that this presentation shows you how you can use the tools of the study of history to corroborate exactly what the prophecies indicate. So it enables you to see it both from the prophetic standpoint and find out that the evidence of history backs it up exactly. Now we'll get started. There's always the question that we ask, why do you study the tribes of Israel? It is, I wouldn't say fashionable, but it is almost an impulse among our younger generations in the church to say, what's the deal with this anyway? And they're facing a double curse. One, they don't know history, and two, they haven't been taught it, and that's why they don't know it. They don't appreciate the significance of that. And we live in a fast-paced communicating age with all of our cell phones, mine set on stun, by the way, hidden down in my briefcase so it doesn't go off while I'm talking. And all the other things that we have, the internet availability, but it doesn't include depth. You can Google something and read the first two sentences and you sort of know something about it, but you don't have any depth in the knowledge of it. And that's what we want to present here. The first time I presented this was, I don't know, 6-7 years ago at a Feast of Tabernacles. And one of the young adults, for the teens and young adults, it was a special Bible study for them. One of the young adults who was sort of coordinating the details, and he ran the audiovisual things for me. And he loved history. I mean, he lives and breathes it whenever he's not, you know, programming computers. So we had to get together for two sessions during the feast that year and talk history, about the history of the tribes and about history in general. And he knows a lot about it, and my daughter does. She's in a history major. One afternoon was at a pub, because this was where they have pubs. And we had dinner and talked for 3 hours with a rapid-fire three-way history discussion between him, my daughter, and I, and had a delightful time. So I said, so how are we going to roll out this Tribe Tracker's Guide to History to the young adults and the teens? And how are we going to present it to them? You know, I was thinking of doing this and how I would write the announcement. And he said, oh, don't mention the word history. I said, why not? He says, well, if you say history, their eyes roll back in their heads and they fall off their chairs and go to sleep. And I could appreciate that. History has not been given the respect that it needs as far as the field of study for many, many decades. That began to be eroding away by the 1970s, and it's just gotten worse. So he said, this is what we'll do. We'll have a young adult and teen activity that afternoon, and then we'll all get together at a certain restaurant. It's two blocks from the hall where we're going to have the Bible study. And so after dinner, we'll all walk over together and you can spring it on them. And I thought, oh boy. Now, most of these young adults I didn't know particularly well, other than just having briefly met them there at the feast. So it's what you call the disinterested audience speech. How do you capture their attention and make it interesting? So I'm praying about this and thinking about it and ransacking my ideas to see what would make it interesting for them. And I thought, okay, here's the idea. So I said, I have a question and I need a volunteer to answer it. This is the first thing out right after the opening prayer. And nobody raised their hand. And I said, what do you want me to tell you the question first? It doesn't work like that. You have to volunteer, then I'll ask you the question. So one of the girls finally, you know, the guy should have done it, but one of the girls did it. So she raised her hand. I happen to know where her name was. So I said, so who are you, Debbie? That's the question. Who are you? So pretty soon she gave me her, you know, full name, where she came from, why she was there, and so on. I said, great, that's your physical identity. But who are you? And the rest of you can chime in. So then there's an interest. This was an odd thing to have to deal with. So one of them gave his spiritual identity, member of the body of Christ, you know, future member of the family of God, and so on. I said, that's good. Where do you come from? That's the next question. And then they tried to answer that in several ways, and I said, who are your people? And they realized they really didn't know a lot about their people, where they came from, what their roots were. I said, okay, we're going to look at some of where you came from. And that's what this is all about. So that's how we started it. It was interesting. Then I launched into the first version of this for about an hour and a half. And the two of the particularly disinterested young adults, because I watch the audience, I usually know what I'm going to be saying, so I'm having fun looking at the audience and reading faces and body language and that sort of thing. And a couple of the fellows, it looked really, really uninterested in anything. By the end of the session, they were sitting on the edge of their chairs studying the maps and the other things that we put up on the screen. So we'll jump into it now. The question comes up, why study history? Somebody famous said, the further backward you look, the further forward you can see. Who said that? It was Churchill. And for two extra points, what does the S stand for in WSC? No, Winston and Churchill, that's the W and the C. What's the middle one? AS. What was it? No. Spencer. Yes, Winston Spencer Churchill. William. I named my cat after him. Winston Spencer Churchill. Actually, he had a hyphenated last name. Their family did, but he didn't use the Spencer part most of the time. He also said a good knowledge of history is like a quiver full of arrows in a debate. Now, I like that one because I'm an archer. I carve longbows, build arrows, hunt with them, you know, target practice all the time. I just enjoy archery. So that was one that I liked. Churchill's, though, backing up to the first one, the further backward you look, the further forward you can see. Let me ask you this. How far back in history can we look, knowing what we know? How far back? And what scripture says that? The Bible is a book of history, of course. So you've got these history markers. How about John 1, verse 1? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Eternity into the past. We can look back that far. Then, if the principle is sound, we should be able to see into eternity into the future. Now, it's not all clear, but we can see into it. We know it's there because it comes out of the past. And that's exactly right. Now, who said the bottom one? Those ignorant of history are doomed to repeat it. George Santayana, very good. You get 2 points for that. Leo Tolstoy also said it. But then again, Leo Tolstoy said enough things to make a door stopper out of War and Peace. There was one other person that even you wouldn't know that said it. Her name was Betty Redfield. She was my American history teacher in high school. And if you were ignorant of history at the end of her class, then you were doomed to repeat it. Okay, here are the hard questions we ask in studying the history of Israel. Was God unfair to choose a model nation? No, God isn't unfair. Were the tribes of Israel intrinsically superior to other nations? No, I have a really sorry history of them that we're going to be looking at. They had potential to do really well. On occasion, they have done well, but mostly they have proven the fact that they're just folks like all the other folks on the earth. And the difference is that God picked them to be a model nation. Was God disrespectful to other peoples of other nations because he gave the tribes of Israel a particular role in history? And the answer is no. He has given roles in history to all kinds of nations. Egypt, you know, just thinking through in the scripture, Assyria, Persia, the Greeks, the Romans, they all have roles in history. They're all mentioned in the Bible and lots of others. Those who are smaller, more regional powers. I forgot the Hittites and the Babylonians. I should throw those in there too. So, no, God has given historical roles to many different nations. He sets kings up and brings them down, as Daniel pointed out. He's the one that makes his final decisions. Now, some reasons why we would track the tribes. Number one, Jesus Christ was prophesied to physically descend through Mary and legally through Joseph from one of the tribes of Israel, which was the tribe of Judah. Number two, Christ promised the 12 apostles that they would each rule one of the 12 tribes in the world tomorrow, in the millennium, in the kingdom of God. And they will. Well, that's not a promise to sneeze at. It has historical significance. Number three, God always identifies key nations and epochs of history. Well, that's always another reason. We understand who those nations are. We have a better understanding of how the Bible applies to us at our time. More reasons. The tribes of Israel were to be a blessing to other nations. Were to be a blessing to other nations. I should have underlined were. Meant to be, as it says at the bottom. I will make you a great nation, and you shall be a blessing, and in you all families of the earth shall be blessed. Sometimes that's been true. And many brethren aren't even of an Israelite background, but when you have attached yourself by living in an Israelite nation, as it was historically, the Kenites, for example, they were the relatives of Zipporah, who was Moses' wife, and Moses invited them to settle with Israel, and they did. And they did some great things in Israel's history during the conquest, or during the period of the judges. It was Jael, the wife of Eber, one of the Kenites, who put the quietus, so to speak, to Sisera, the commander of the Canaanite forces they were fighting at the time of Deborah. Further down the line, King Jehu, of the northern kingdom of Israel, he replaced the dynasty of Ahab. In fact, he was given the responsibility of eradicating it. King Jehu had an advisor whose name was Jonadab. And by that time, he was of the clan of the Kenites known as Rechab. So he was Jonadab the Rechabite. That name surfaces in Jeremiah 35. Much later, at the time that Judah was under siege by the Babylonians in the 500s, late 500s B.C., and the Rechabites had moved into Jerusalem. They normally didn't live in the city, but they moved in because of the Babylonians. And Jonadab's descendants were asked to meet with Jeremiah at a certain service room or side room in the temple area. And God told him, offer the Rechabites wine. So he had a big bowl of wine and lots of cups. And he invited all the leaders of the Rechabites in. And they came in and they said, here's some wine, have some wine. And they said, thank you, but no. Jonadab, our father, Jonadab the Rechabite, hundreds of years earlier, Jonadab told us never to drink wine or have anything to do with anything from the grapevine. Probably they addicted very easily to alcohol. And Jonadab sensed that, and so, you know, that would have been a genetic thing. And so he told him, you just don't drink. And don't own land. Remember, you are sojourners among the Israelites. But their lot was with Israel as a result of that. And likewise, that would be the same principle today. More reasons. The ascendancy of the tribes of Israel herald the second coming of Christ, as does their downfall. The promise that they would rise, particularly the tribe of Joseph, to great heights of world power, which came to pass in around 1800 to the first few years of the 1800s, when America got the Louisiana Purchase and Britain suddenly began to develop a massive empire after they thought they'd lost it when they lost the Revolution, or the War of Rebellion, as they called it. So the ascendancy of particularly the tribe of Joseph of Israel heralded the second coming. That was, in a sense, a kicking into four-wheel drive of the end time. We don't think of it as the end time because we look at the end time where everything's degenerating. And we see the influence and the power of the tribes of national tribes of Israel today declining. So both its ascendancy and its downfall picture or anticipate the second coming of Christ. And then finally, the one in red, God's faithfulness to fulfill his promises to Abraham's descendants proves his faithfulness to fulfill his promises to you and me and anybody else, no matter whether they're Israelite or non-Israelite. In the Bible, there are two kinds of people. There are Israelites and there are non-Israelites, which are known as Gentiles. In Hebrew, that's goyim. It only means that. The word heathen in the King James simply is the word nations. It's also the word goyim in the general sense. Okay. Now we're going to kick into overdrive here. I've got to watch my watch. We'll cover the first half. The second half is tomorrow. But I think you'll find this all interesting. We need to look at this. The Bible is a superstructure of history. You'll have these noted on your handouts, the references. This is Acts 17. He has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth and has determined their pre-appointed times and boundaries of their dwellings. That's a key geography scripture. That tells you that God has planned out history. And he has planned for what he would do with various nations. In particular, of course, with Israel, as we'll see. But he has worked with all nations because all nations come from Adam and Eve. Everybody does. Genesis 10 talks about the post-flood because the family of man expanded out from Adam and Eve and then it contracted back to the family of Noah, the eight people who survived the flood. And then they repopulated afterwards according to their generations and their nations. And from these, the nations were divided on the earth after the flood. Now, you know what event it was when they were divided, don't you? The Tower of what? Of Babel, which means confusion. And you think, well, why would God do something that was confusing? And the answer is, it wasn't confusing to God. It was only confusing to mankind. Because for God, that was organization. It was time to move out and go to your own homelands that he had prepared for them. He left mountain ranges where he wanted mountain ranges to be, and coastlines and rivers and deserts, so that people would have homelands. All the tribes that would grow into nations would have homelands. He already had that plan. So with the Tower of Babel, it was simply time for them to move away, go establish their own territory. God's plan for Israel. I would encourage you to take time to read Deuteronomy 32 in its entirety. It's actually a song of Moses, a poem, a psalm, if you will. But it is a historical one of quite interest. Quite a lot of interest. When the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. So even the way that God made the topography of the land, as I said, mountain ranges, coastlines, rivers, deserts, he had in mind that he would have a nation, he would have a people, and this is where they'd be. Promises made to Abraham. We read that one earlier in Genesis 12. It has to do with God's grace. Bear in mind, God's grace is not simply the forgiveness of sin. That is the apex of it. That's the highest form of it, indeed. It's a spiritual grace. But God, it means favor. Grace means favor. It doesn't mean pixie dust. It means God's favor. And that can be physically demonstrated as well as spiritually demonstrated. So God has given the nations by His grace. He gives them air to breathe every morning, water to drink, food to eat. It all comes by God's favor that we survive anywhere in the world. So that God's grace to the Israelites, there were particular promises that were made. Multinational greatness, certainly, and descendants to be a blessing to others. Now we look at the history of Israel. Here's a key point to understand off the top. Patriarchal characteristics help define the nature of each tribe. Starting with, of course, the fathers. Abraham was the father of many. And we know Abraham's character. He's also the father of the faithful. And so we would expect that there would be a certain element of faithfulness that would come from through Israel. And evidence of that is right here on your lap. We have Israel's Bible. It's their book, in one sense, because it's so much about the tribes of Israel. When I say Israel in that sense, I don't mean the modern nation state of Israel, which is only largely the tribe of Judah, but of Benjamin and Levi. That they're only a part of Israel. They're not the whole concept of Israel. So patriarchal characteristics help define the nature of each tribe. For example, Isaac means laughter. So what is laughter? How does laughter devolve into a cultural national trait? It's easy. People who can laugh at themselves, you don't mind being around. People who can't laugh at themselves, they can only laugh derisively of others, are called dictators and despots and lunatics. You have to have a sense of humor. You ought to be able to laugh at yourself. Isaac could do that. Laughter was what he did. It means that because you don't take yourself too seriously, you have a sense of fair play. That you're not the high and mighty, you're one of the many. And people can talk to you and you can talk to them. When you take it out into a national entity, the sense of fair play is going to be reflected in the laws. And one of the key elements of the laws, the key principles that extracts from that, is what we call the rule of law. The concept of the rule of law has largely been talked about in American history. It was not talked about a lot before that. Even in England, because you had the kings who believed that they ruled by divine right, and therefore they were above the law. And many nations had the same concept. America really fleshed out the thinking of the rule of law. We have not managed it perfectly by any means, but we have to a significant degree. Jacob was renamed Israel. Israel, remember the wrestling match in Genesis 32. He became a prince with God, or one who prevails with God. So there's the thinking of God and a connection to God, the true God of the Bible. Israel's 12 sons became 12 tribes. Each of those patriarchs then would have a microcosm in the sense culturally or characteristically of the tribe that would descend from them. Jacob's prophecies in Genesis 48 and 9 give you some of the key tribal prophecies that also define the nations that would come from that tribe. What you may not have remembered is that Genesis 49 is echoed in Deuteronomy 33 by Moses. Now, Moses didn't give a prophecy of each of the tribes, but of most of them. He covered them. Jacob covered all 12. Then we have another very interesting study. When you read, how many have tried to read through the Bible successfully? How many tried and weren't as successful? Most of you were successful. That's good. However, wasn't it fun when you got to the begets? Oh, this is so exciting, and so-and-so begets so-and-so, and he begets so-and-so, and so-and-so, and so on and so forth. And you probably kind of skipped over those. You know, you didn't try to think, oh, yeah, I wonder what that name means. And, oh, I didn't remember, that one's over here too. Now, well, you wonder, why did God spend so many column inches in His inspired Word to put in genealogies? When you start tracking the tribes, suddenly it makes perfect sense. Oh, that's fascinating stuff. So here are the key ones. Genesis 46, that's when the expanded family of Jacob moved into Egypt to join Joseph, who was already there. And it tells who the tribal patriarchs were and what their children were and their wives' names and so on. Numbers chapter 1 and 26 are the genealogies listed by us in a census at the beginning of the wandering, you know, when the Exodus had just taken place, and then at the end, 40 years later, when they're ready to go into the Promised Land, they took another census. When you do that, you realize, okay, now we're seeing the names that existed about 300 or 400 years after the time that they went into Egypt. And then 400 years later, after the conquest of the Promised Land, the time of David, in 1 Chronicles 2 through 8, those chapters, there's a whole other census taken. And this gives the tribal leaders, who they were, who their sons were, and those sons have now become the major clans or families of the tribe. And then sometimes grandsons had also risen to clan status. You know, I'm using the term that the Scots use a lot, but clan is the concept that we're thinking. It's an expanded family. Now, you'll find, interestingly, between Numbers 1 and 1 Chronicles, or Numbers and 1 Chronicles, that 400 years, the names of some of the clans have changed their spelling. Now, you can still recognize them. They're the same name, but it seems to be pronounced a little differently. Now, that happened in Hebrew over 400 years' time. What you then realize, okay, this is a key, because if I'm going to track clans and tribal names through history, I'm going to expect them to be maybe spelled a little bit differently from one time to another and from one language change to another. That's a very important key in tracking tribes. Tribal conduct during the time of the judges. That began around 1400 BC when Joshua conquered the Promised Land. The tribal behavior indicated future national characteristics, what they would be like. So the source there is the Judges. Now we're going to look at Deborah's song, because there are a couple of key tracks there. In Deborah chapter 5, Judges chapter 5 is the Song of Deborah, is what it's called. She mentions Ephraim and Benjamin. These are the tribes. Seven of the tribes are mentioned in her song. Ephraim and Benjamin, Machir, Zebulun and Issachar, Dan, Reuben, Gilead, Asher, and Naphtali. And you think, well, those are all in the north. Yes, they are. They're all in the north. Who's Machir and who's Gilead? Machir and Gilead, that's the tribe of Manasseh. And here's why. Manasseh had one son. His name was Machir. And then Machir had a son, and his name was Gilead. And the half-tribe area, remember when they migrated into the... I'll have to come back to that later. When they migrated up into the Promised Land under Moses, they conquered the east bank of the Jordan all the way to the north. And half of the tribe of Manasseh said, we want to live here. And then Gad said right below them, we want to live down here. And then Reuben said, and we want to live down here. Right, all along the east side of the Jordan. And Moses thought, oh no, they're all splitting apart and we haven't even gotten across the Jordan River. And so he went to God and God said, that's okay. However, when you are, you know, leading the conquest across the Jordan, or when Joshua does, these tribes must be at the forefront. So they must send their armies across to help their brothers, which they did. So we have a half-tribe of Manasseh. That's Gilead. That area up there by the Sea of Galilee to the east is called Gilead. Therefore, the main part of Manasseh, which is over on the other side, just north of Ephraim, that would be called Machir. That would be the one that was labeled after Machir, more often than not. Now, Reuben, she called up Reuben, and no offense to the French, Reuben is just the ancestor of most of the French. Reuben had great resolves of heart. Oh, they felt very strongly about the crisis that Deborah and Barak were facing with the war that was suddenly on with the northern Canaanite kingdom, who had a very powerful army. Very great resolves of heart. And so she said this, "As Issachar, so was Barak, sent into the valley under his command." So Issachar was brave. "Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart." And she says, "Why do you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the pipings for the flocks? The divisions of Reuben have great searchings of heart." They didn't come and help, but they had great searchings of heart. "Oh, we're with you in spirit. Want you to know that. But we have these sheep, and we're playing some music right now." Gilead didn't help either, the half-tribe of Manasseh. Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan. And it was his tribe who was hosting the battle. The battle took place in the land of Manasseh, the main body of Manasseh. But Gilead didn't want to be bothered to come across and help. And then she was not happy with Dan. She said, "Why did Dan remain on ships? What's the deal here, guys? We need you on land. But you know what? There's a trap right there. Dan had ships. I thought they were just poor country farmers, these Israelites, and they had no idea how to sail across the Sea of Galilee, which is just a lake, let alone sail the Mediterranean." Oh, no, no. Dan was already shipping by the 1200s. Dan had ships. And frankly, so did Asher. Asher stayed in her inlets. Asher was immediately north of Dan. If you remember on a map today of Israel, you know where Tel Aviv is, out on the coast. And immediately north of Tel Aviv is the ancient city of Joppa, which Peter went to later when he stayed with Simon the Tanner. And then that was all the tribe of Dan. That's the territory that Samson came from. They were a coastal tribe, Dan was. You think, well, what about Dan up to the north? Well, that shows that they were colonizers, because they went up and colonized this town called Laish. And a regiment of them went up there and said, "This is a cool town. Let's kill everybody and just live here." And so they did. And Dan had that proclivity as well. But at this particular battle, they said, "Why did Dan remain in ships?" And Asher by his inlets. Asher's inheritance was immediately north of Joppa along the coast, going all the way up to Haifa. And all the way actually to Tyre. So they were a sea-going tribe as well. Now, let me show you some other things, because this is important. If the Israelites were sailors, then they didn't have to walk everywhere that they went, and they could project themselves out and about. We would expect that, because we see numerous links between the ancient Celts and the Israelites. The Iberian Peninsula of Spain and Portugal is a classic case. But here's further evidence of ships in the history of Israel. King Solomon also built a fleet of ships down at Eilat on the Red Sea. And then Hiram was the king of Tyre. But he was in an alliance. He was very friendly with Israel. He worked with David. He was a close friend of David. And he was a close friend of Solomon. And so Tyre sent his men, his servants, to sail with the Israelite fleet down there, in addition to having some of them sailing with his fleet out of Tyre. So the Israelites were active sailors at the time of Solomon. Furthermore, in 1 Kings 10, we find out, "For the king had merchant ships." By the way, merchant ships, the literal translation is ships of Tarshish. And you think, well, where was Tarshish? Even Paul wanted to go to Tarshish. Tarshish is in Spain. Tartus, I think, is the name of the modern city in the ancient site. But Tarshish had a larger meaning in rabbinical literature. It meant the Atlantic Ocean, the way beyond. You know, the land's out there on the edge and off across that Atlantic Ocean. And why we think it's across is this. Had merchant ships at sea with the fleet of Hiram. So you had Israelite fleet and a Phoenician fleet sailing. And once every 3 years, these ships came bringing gold, silver, apes, and monkeys. And you're like, why'd they bring apes? We don't know. It could just as easily mean peacocks. It's an obscure translation. They brought various things, obviously. What can you do in sailing 3 years? The commentaries say that they sailed around the Horn of Africa and they camped for a year. Sailed for a year, they camped for a year, got stuff, and then they sailed back. I don't know if any of you have a Navy or Merchant Marine background, but most of us can realize that sailors don't go someplace and camp for a year. They're already camping on the boat. They go someplace, they pick up stuff, and then they keep going. They are sailors, not campers. And they want to get home sometimes. In 3 years, you can circumnavigate the globe. Magellan proved that. Sorry, Magellan didn't prove that. His crew did. He died along the way. But his crew circumnavigated in more modern times, during the Elizabethan era. And circumnavigation requires, in a sailing ship, about 3 years traveling time. So the potential for this meaning, circumnavigation of the globe, is significant, especially when you look at some of the archaeological things of the Americas and elsewhere. That by the time of Solomon, which was roughly David and Solomon, is about 1000 B.C., they knew their way around the oceans. Now, we jump to another point in history, and this is really important. The one, aside from our shipping, we're coming back to another shipping thing in a minute. The house of Judah and the house of Israel. The house of Judah became known as the Jews. The house of Israel, the northern kingdom, had its capital in Samaria. It was therefore, after that, the Israelites. So the Jews were not referred to as Israelites after Solomon died, because they had a civil war. And so they had two different kingdoms. Instead of one kingdom, one united monarchy of Israel, they had two nations there. And the Jews were the ones who had a capital in Jerusalem. They were the tribe of Judah predominantly, and Benjamin and part of Levi. And then the house of Israel were the rest of them. Most of traditional Christianity, most of the world, doesn't understand this concept at all. The reason is if there is a black curtain across the knowledge of the movement of the tribes of Israel is because they don't know the difference between Jews and Israelites. It's really easy to figure it out when you just read those chapters involved. You can see it, but they assume that the Jews are the Israelites and that's it. They don't get any, and this is a really easy point, but they miss it completely. Now, the impact of King Omri. 800s, late 800s B.C. You think, who in the world was he? Well, he was a king of the house of Israel. You don't remember his name, because we don't. He didn't do it a lot in the Bible. He was a bad king, but, I mean, Israel never had a good one. They were all bad kings. He wasn't any particularly badder than other ones. The particular bad king that they had was his son. Largely because of who he married. His son was Ahab. Ahab married Jezebel. Jezebel wasn't an Israelite. She was a Sidonian. She was a Phoenician. She was actually the high priestess of the Phoenicians. So they institutionalized Baal worship in northern Israel. That's why King Omri then is connected to his more famous son. But Omri had a very powerful impact. Number one, he renewed northern Israel's alliance with Phoenicia, including the sailing. And the history books and the Bible commentaries even recognize that. I was just reading an atlas, a Bible atlas the other day, that identified that particular point. Likewise, he impressed the beginnings of what was going to be a great empire of Assyria. And I'm not sure why he impressed the Assyrians so much, because they were landlubbers. They didn't have an ocean to sail in, so that wasn't such impressive. But possibly it was this. And Micah, who lived at that time, contemporary with Isaiah and Amos, He said, for the statutes of Omri are kept, and the works of Ahab's house are done. And you walk in their counsels, and I make you a desolation, and your inhabitants a hissing. Therefore you shall bear the reproach of my people. Ahab and his father Omri were not good kings. They didn't teach the people God's law, but it does appear that even so, Ahab or Omri had some legislative ability that in some way impressed the Assyrians. And here's why. I'll get to it in a minute. We'll get to why he impressed the Assyrians. That's coming up. It had to do with what they called the nation after that. Jehoshaphat. And you're like, okay, I know Jehoshaphat was the king of Judah, but when? Well, it's easy. He was contemporary with King Ahab in the north. So right just after Omri's reign is when Jehoshaphat became king down in Judah. Jehoshaphat made merchant ships to go to Ophir for gold. Now, you'll note, this is in 2 Kings 20, or 1 Kings 22, Ophir, is in the next passage, is connected to Tarshish, as if they're the same place. So, then Ahaziah, the son of Ahab. So, Ahab died, and Ahaziah became his king, his son. And he said to Jehoshaphat, let my servants go with your servants in the ships. But Jehoshaphat wouldn't agree to it. And here's the background as to why. We get this from Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 20. After this, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, allied himself with Ahaziah, king of Israel, who acted very wickedly. And he allied himself with him to make ships to go to Tarshish, the other place that said Ophir. So Ophir and Tarshish seem to have the same meaning. And they made the ships at Ezion-Geber, which is down in Elath. Again, this shows us the evidence of northern Israel's active sailing industry. And they're trying to get the Jews to go in with them and start a fleet from down in, that would go down into the Indian Ocean. But Eliezer was a prophet, the son of Dodava, of wherever he was from, prophesied against Jehoshaphat and said, because you've allied yourself with Ahaziah, the Lord has destroyed your works, and the ships were wrecked, so they were not able to go to Tarshish. So the attempted Jewish-Israelite alliance at that time was cut short by God himself. He didn't want them sailing together at that time. But the northern kingdom of Israel continued to sail. And internationally, not just the Mediterranean. Now, here we have the Assyrians coming. 745, they invaded Israel and made it into a vassal kingdom. The king of Israel at the time paid them off with 1,000 talents of silver, so that he could continue to be the king. But from then on, they were basically renting from the Assyrians. But they rebelled because they're Israelites, and they're good at that. And about 10 years later, in 734, the Assyrians came back in a punitive expedition. This was the second invasion, but it was the first wave of captivity. And at this time, they took Gilead, that's half-tribe of Manasseh, and Galilee, and that's going to be Naphtali and Zebulun. And the half-tribe of Gilead is going to be half Manasseh and Gad and Reuben and part of Simeon. And then they hauled them off to a captive to Assyria, as the scripture says there in 2 Kings 15. Now, here we have the territories that were taken. Here's Reuben, there's Gad. The whole area was sometimes referred to as Gilead. In fact, there's the name Gilead right there. So that group there were taken. They swept down the east bank, and then they took out the Galilee area. It may have included some of Asher at that time, but certainly Naphtali is mentioned, possibly Zebulun and a little bit of Issachar were all taken. Simeon, the reason I say Simeon, because Simeon had moved their influence over here. They were not given an inheritance because he was too violent, so they were diffused primarily in the tribe of Judah, but otherwise scattered through the land, so there would have been some of them taken. Final captivity, because they rebelled again. They lost half their nation, half their population, to a massive empire, and they decided to do it again. Maybe it'll work better the second time. Israelites are good at that. Third invasion, last captivity. This time the emperor was Shalmaneser. The ninth year of Hosea, the king of Assyria, took Samaria, that was their capital, and carried Israel away to Assyria. And he placed them in the Halah and the Habor and the river Gozan and the cities of the Medes. And so we have the river Habor and Gola up in here. Cities of the Medes going to be up, and actually a little bit further north would be more of where Media was. Our arrows are a little bit to the far to the south on that particular map. Only Judah was left. The children of Israel sinned against the Lord, so he removed them from his sight. None were left, the tribe of Judah alone. Being the dominant tribe, we already know that Judah and Benjamin were connected because the city of Jerusalem was in Benjamin's inheritance. And I need to hurry. All right. By the early 600s, Assyria had reached the apex of its power, but it had the rise of two groups of people called the Cimmerians and the Scythians. They were actually Israelites. I'll show you where their names come from here in a minute. And then by 612, the Medes and the Babylonians had conquered Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. And then a few years later, in the famous Battle of Carchemish, they put the quietus to the Assyrians, and Assyria disappeared from history, as the historians say. But they said the same thing in the Ten Tribes. They have no idea where they went. Most historians, because they don't go looking. They went wandering is what they did, and so did the Assyrians. Fall of Jerusalem took place in 586 B.C. That was, of course, the Babylonians by that time. The Jews were in captivity for 70 years, and they were allowed to begin to come back, reestablish Judea as a homeland by the Persians, allowed them to do that. The lost 10 tribes never returned en masse, at least yet, but they will. Self-evident prophecies, the scepter will not depart from Judah. That's a whole other study in tribe trackers, but Judah's royal line is in the British royal family. And how it got there is a whole fascinating other story, which we're not covering extensively today. We have the great prophecy in Genesis 48, identifying Manasseh as the single greatest nation the world will ever see, and Ephraim to be the single largest multitude or company of nations. Manasseh became the United States of America, and Ephraim became the British nations and the British Empire, which still exists in the form of the British Commonwealth. Do you know today that there are nations that have asked and have been allowed to join the British Commonwealth that were never part of the British Empire? Because it's a trade bloc, and they get favorable trade status when they do that, and so it helps them economically. So even in her weakness, Ephraim, or England, has been able to do some good for the nations. Tribe tracking, national names. Eber is the great-grandfather of Abraham, and his descendants are called Hebrews. But the Hebrew label is attached to Abraham's descendants, but he comes from Eber. Omri, the king, is another key name. And Isaac. We had a neighbor in South Dakota when I grew up. He was a Dutch immigrant, came over, bought a farm. We were good friends with him. His name was Cornelius Moss, the M-A-A-S, he said Moss, like we'd say M-O-S-S. But his nickname was Case, and that's how he spelled it, double E's. Case Moss. Now, he raised sheep, we had cattle, and he was a Sabbath keeper too, so our work schedules work together. He had newer machinery. Sometimes we needed to borrow that. In return, my brother and I would go and work in his fields at times, or work with his sheep. He sold a load of ewes to a sheep rancher in eastern Montana, about 300-400 miles away. And this was in the day where people, you know, had a certain trust. And so he asked the trucker, "When you deliver the sheep, will you please bring back the check?" And so he did. But when he got there, the rancher said, "Okay, who do I make the check out to?" "Well, his name is Case Moss." And the rancher thought, "Case. Case, what's that?" "Oh, that must be that English abbreviation for Charles, Chase." That's what he thought. I tried to figure it out. Why would he come do what he did? But I'm thinking he heard Case and thought it meant Chase, which he knew as an abbreviation for Charles, but nobody in eastern Montana is called Charles. They're either Chuck or more likely Charlie. And Moss? Moss. That must be Moose. So, Charlie Moose. That's who he wrote the check to. Sent it back with the trucker. The trucker gave it to Case, took it to the bank, looked at it, said, "Yep, that's you." And he cashed it. So, You see how names can change based on what people are hearing and what their their understanding is. Here's another interesting one, even name things. Osage Orange Tree, sometimes called Hedge Apple. But when the French began to explore the eastern side of the United States, because they came in earlier than the British, they noticed that the tribes all used that wood from that tree to make their bows. And they had no idea what the tribes called it, so they called it the wood of the bow. Bois, B-O-I-S, is wood in French. And the D apostrophe, is of. And arc, like this, is bow for them. Bois d'arc. The Texans came, and they heard the French calling it bois d'arc. They said, well, you must mean bow d'arc. Because they don't speak French. So it became bow d'arc. They got a bow still in there, just at the wrong end of the word. But you see how names can morph just in our modern times. Direction of wandering. This is important. Surely these Israelites shall come from afar. This is the time of the second Exodus, the feast time, when they're being returned back to the promised land after coming out of captivity of the great tribulation. Look, those from the north and the west, and these from the south. So the bulk are coming from the north and west, and some from the south. Sinim means south in Hebrew. Now, Eber, transliteration from Ibri or Ivri. Notice the B and the V are interchangeable. B and V are interchangeable. So Ivri, Ibri, and its root, it's from the Hebrew root word of Aver. Now, bear in mind, in Hebrew, ancient Hebrew, only consonants were written. They had no vowels that were written down. They had the vowel sounds, but they were handed on by oral tradition. They didn't write them down. So the vowels can change over time very easily, but the consonant sounds can change. It can remain the same, but they may have different English letters representing them because V and B are different words, they're different letters, but they sound so much alike phonetically. And we mistake them now. Sometimes I get people who write me a letter and they address it to Randy Steiber. It's not a B, it's a V, like in Victor, in the middle of my name. So even now you can see B's and V's. Now, here are some of the names of them. Hibernia, Tiber, that's a river. You think, behold it, that's in Italy, yeah? But it's got the Iber name in it, doesn't it? Iberia, that's like the Iberia Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, which has a river called the Iber River in northern Spain on the Mediterranean side, just south of the Pyrenees Mountains between France and Spain. But it's called on many maps the Ebro. So you still have the BR core, the variation of Eber. Siberia. What were the Israelites doing in Siberia? It used to be warmer there. You see, they rode horses that gave off carbon monoxide instead of carbon dioxide, and they polluted the air, they caused global warming way back when. The earth has warmed and cooled and warmed and cooled pretty much on its own. And at one time it was warmer in Siberia. Then there was a change, sort of an ice age to some degree, and then they moved south. Hibernia. Hibernia is an ancient name for Ireland. The Hebrides are the islands outside of Scotland, on the northwest side of Scotland, to the inners and the outers. Eboracum, that's York. The B has been lost, but it's York, York. Hyboria, what the Greeks referred to as in ancients called the northern part of England, was the Hyborians, meaning the North Hebrews. And the Humber River is on... is right up south of York, and everything north of that is called Northumbria, Northern Eber, Northern Hebrew. So here we have we're going to start here in Israel. We've got Hebron, that's named after Eber. That was David's first capital. And then you go west, you've got the Tiber River, and there are historical traditions that would place Israelites there. And then the Iberian Peninsula, where you have the Iberian Celts, probably early Celts, probably colonies. The Ebro or Iber River is right there on that line. And then you go north, you have Hibernia, which is Ireland, Inner and Outer Hebrides in Scotland, Eboric in York, Aberdeen in Scotland, that's got the Iber, or could easily be Eber, the Oder River here, Bergen in Scotland, and this is just a sampling. And you think, well, some of those might not be derived from Eber, and that's true, they might not be. But the majority are. But the vast majority, which in historical clues is huge. So that's the name of Eber. Omri, the Black Obelisk. This is in the British Museum. I believe it was found by French archaeologists, one of the early archaeological discoveries. And here is the bas-relief with an inscription that says, "The tribute of Jehu, son of Kumri." And hold it, we know who Jehu was, or Jehu. He's the one who killed off the dynasty of Ahab. Well, he also killed off the dynasty of Omri, because Ahab was Omri's son. But the Assyrians, because this is an Assyrian inscription, the Assyrians declared that the land of Israel was Matbit Gomri. Mat means land of, bit or beth in Hebrew, a similar word, means house. Land of the house of Omri. That's what they called Israel. They named it after Omri. For some reason, he made a big impression on them. Therefore, we're going to look for his name in history. And you'll find that the Assyrians called Omri Gomri or Gomri. They couldn't pronounce it. It's like many, even American Chinese, still have difficulty saying their R's in the middle of a word. They're very sorry about that. But R's come out as L's, because that's the way the Chinese say those things. And it's very difficult for them to make the shift. In South Africa, the Afrikaans don't put milk in their tea, they put mulk. And we had an Afrikaner who was in the ministry years ago, and one of the ministers in England, I went to Brick and Wood, and he said, "Dr. McCarthy, what do you put in your tea?" I said, "I put mulk." "Now, can you say milk?" "It's not mulk, it's an I, milk." And he said, and he tried really hard, and it came out, mulk. That's how they say the I sound. It's mulk in the Afrikaans down in South Africa. Now, Omri, you will find in the name Gomri, Homeri, you know, an extra vowel and an extra syllable that way will sometimes morph into it. Gomri, Cimmerians, it's a hard C. We would see that, we'll call it Cimmerian, but it's a hard C. It should be Cimmerian. The Welsh call themselves the Cimbri yet today. They know that they're descendants from going back. And this etymology, this progress of the words, and there are some other ones that are used in history, is one of the best established in English history itself. They recognize that. They don't think about the significance of it anymore, but they recognize that connection. Isaac. There's a prophecy about Isaac when there was the Hagar incident was taking place, and she was about to be removed from the household of Abraham along with her son Ishmael. And God told Abraham, he said, "Whatever Sarah said to you, listen to her voice. For in Isaac shall your seed be called." That's a prophecy that the tribes would carry the moniker of Isaac in some fashion. But nobody says Isaac, they say Itzhak. Itzhak, or Itzhak. The consonantal core of Hebrew in the Hebrew is the SK, or hard, the S and the hard C, the SKU. So that's what happened. The western branch of Isaac became known as the Scythians. We would say Scythian when we look at it, and we think of the word scythe, which probably comes from them. But it is an SK sound more than an SC sound. For example, Scute, we recognize that. Scotia, we always use it in hard C in Scotia, like in Nova Scotia. Or in Scotland, you've got the SK sound. Or in Scandia, an ancient name for Scandinavia. Sku. That's Isaac's name. That's the core of Isaac's name. The eastern branch of the Isaac label. And typically, this was a grouping of clans and tribes that were milling about together or organized together at various times. They went by and were known as the Saka, or Saka. east, and they were east of the Caspian Sea. The Scythians were normally, the Scythians were on the western side of the Caspian, between the Caspian and the Black Sea, because they went up through the Caucasus Mountains, which is a range that runs east and west between the Black and Caspian Seas, and there's a certain pass called the Pass of Israel, and then they went down into that, up and around the Black Sea eventually, and they became the land of Scythia included Eastern Europe for many centuries. Many centuries. Bear in mind, from 700 B.C. to 500 A.D., which is the time of Israel's wandering, in 500 A.D., the Anglo-Saxons and the Jutes invaded England and established it as a homeland. From that time forward, languages began to take on their own shape. English, German, Dutch, French, so on and so forth. Prior to that time, they mostly could speak, they could understand each other throughout that section of Europe. So from 700 B.C., 700 words, to 500 A.D., that's 1,200 years of wandering. 1,200 years. How many American histories are in 1,200 years? About 5.5 American histories, if we are 238 years old. So when you think about that, think of all the history we have just from 1776. It's a massive amount of history. And you think, well, how could you squeeze all this stuff in? Well, they had lots of time. All these things happened. They became nations. They were great. Then they collapsed. Then they moved. Then somebody else came. And this happened. And that happened. But they had plenty of time for all of that history to take place. The Saka were known as the Sakae as they began to move over toward Europe much later than the Scythians did. Sakasini, Sakasones, sons of Isaac is what that means. And then finally simply shortened to Saxons, when they got into Europe. In archaeology, we have the Behistun rock inscription, which you probably haven't heard of, but it is on the road between Tehran and Baghdad, from between Iran and Iraq. You can see it up there. This is a very carefully, meticulously drawn picture by Sir Henry Rawlinson, a British archaeologist in the 1830s. He climbed up and sketched and made rubbings of all the inscriptions. There we have King Darius the Great. This is not the Darius of Daniel's time. This one came later, about 500 B.C. And here are the men who are the chieftains or the kings that he conquered. And here's this odd fellow at the back that looks like what you think is an elf, but he's not. He's got a pointed hat, slightly exaggerated there, and boots and trousers compared to sandals and togas for the rest of them. That was the classic Scythian or Saka dress. Boots, trousers, they rode horses. They wore boots. And they wore trousers because they rode horses. Not everybody did. And they had pointed hats. And those are archaeological markers that they're looking for. Now, Darius the Great, list of the nations he conquered, they found out that the inscriptions were exact translations line for line across these three different languages. Sir Henry Rawlinson was a historian as well as a British soldier. He understood Old Persian. He understood Susian. What he didn't understand was Assyrian or early Babylonian, the same language. He didn't understand the Assyrian language. They couldn't translate it. And they had found cuneiform tablets by the Gobs when they located Nineveh. But they couldn't translate them until he did the rubbings off the Behistun rock. And then they found out that since they knew Persian and Susian, then they could easily break the code and they could translate Assyrian. It was a huge breakthrough in the 1840s and 50s. Therefore, the conclusion was that the Sakae and the Saka were the same people as the Gimiri or the Cimmerians, who were the same people as the Scythians and the Celts. They're all the same peoples, and the Behistun rock provided that basis. In fact, his brother, who was a historian more than an adventurer, his brother George Rawlinson, said, "We have reasonable grounds for regarding the Gimiri or the Cimmerians and the Sakae of the Behistun rock as identical with the Bet Kumri, or the House of Omri, of Samaria, or the Lost Ten Tribes of Israel." So they understood that. We end at 8:30, right, this morning? Does anybody know what time we end at? Okay. Well, we're going to break it off right here. Tomorrow we'll be back at 8:30. We will even go faster so that I can get through all the rest of it. But we will get into the tribal and clan names. Have a look through with your handout. Please be sure to bring it back in the morning. It'll be helpful to understand what we're covering then.